Hello, and welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Natalie Wood. I can't wait for you to listen to this episode, which tells the fascinating story so far of VEXAS syndrome, an autoinflammatory disorder that was only discovered in 2020. Despite such a short amount of time passing since the first patients were identified, a vast amount has been learned about this life-threatening condition. Not only is it reshaping how we think about inflammatory diseases, it's also driving a truly multidisciplinary approach to research, diagnosis and care, bridging, as it does, rheumatology, immunology, hematology, dermatology and genetics. So without further ado, I invite you to sit back and listen as Dr. Peter Grayson shares his many insights into VEXAS syndrome, as well as his hopes for the future. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Shreya Nanda, a senior clinical content manager at Springer Medicine, focusing on rheumatology and oncology. Today, we're going to be talking about VEXAS syndrome. And in addition to our expert guest, I'm also be delighted to be joined by my co-host, who I will now hand over to so she can introduce herself.
Hi, Shreya. Thanks for having me. My name is Sarah Onora, and I'm the chief editor of the journal Nature Reviews Rheumatology.
So, Sarah, before you introduce our guest, I have a quick question for you, because when I proposed this episode, I suggested a few topics, but this was the one that you were most keen on. So can you tell us why?
Well, we've covered VEXAS syndrome in Nature Reviews Rheumatology since the first reports came out in 2020, and the story is fascinating. You've got the discovery of a completely new type of disease that was basically hiding in plain sight, and the research around VEXAS has led to new ways of thinking about autoinflammatory diseases and somatic mutations within just a few years. We're delighted to have with us Dr. Peter Grayson from the National Institutes of Health in the USA. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
So we've mentioned VEXAS syndrome was first identified only a few years ago in 2020. Peter, can you tell us a bit about how the discovery came about?
Sure. So this disease was initially discovered at the intramural research program of the National Institutes of Health, which is a program in Bethesda, Maryland, where we do kind of high-risk, high-reward clinical translational basic research. And really, the story, I think, came about in two different directions. One was a clinical direction, and one was a genetic direction. And from the clinical side, we initially identified these patients from three main cohorts. One of them was this undiagnosed disease program, which was started at the NIH and is now a network of centers around the United States. And this program allows physicians and patients themselves to be referred into the intramural program at the NIH for evaluation. And often we see patients who don't fit the textbook, that you can't classify their disease, there's no firm diagnosis. And it's really a cohort that's ripe for disease discovery. And the other cohort is Dan Kastner's fever clinic. And so Dan Kastner specializes in patients with autoinflammatory syndromes. These are often pediatric patients with diseases that occur genetically early in life, but he also sees adult onset patients. And then the third cohort was my cohort. And so I've been at the NIH for over 10 years and started a translational research program in vasculitis. So we see patients with all different forms of vasculitis. And as it so happened, we had interest in a disease called relapsing polychondritis, which is a disease of cartilage inflammation, as well as many different forms of vasculitis. And that is the clinical features that a lot of these patients with VEXAS have. From the genetic side of things, though, is where the story gets really interesting, because these patients come through the NIH and we often get exome sequencing. So we sequence their DNA and those go into databases that we use to discover diseases and look for novel genetic variants in association with specific clinical phenotypes. But what happened in the VEXAS story is there was a fellow named David Beck who was working in Dan Kastner's lab, and he had a pretty radical idea about disease discovery, which we've called a genotype-first approach. And what that meant is that he went into those genetic databases and applied filtering algorithms to try to identify patients that had shared genetic variants that were novel, not described in any healthy human population database. And so from this exercise, he found the first three patients that ended up having what we now know as VEXAS syndrome. And he did this not by looking at their clinical features, not by looking at the medical records, just purely analyzing genetic data. And when those three patients popped out, they all had a missense mutation in a gene called UBA1. Then he went back to the chart and started realizing, oh, these are patients that have been seen in Peter Grayson's clinic and Dan Kastner's clinic. And that sort of united us and got us going.
These patients who you discovered all had the same underlying mutation, did they all have similar clinical features?
they all had two major features, which is what made them stand out to us originally, in that they had very difficult to control inflammation throughout the body, but in specific locations as well. And that was combined with progressive bone marrow failure. And clinically, we were really struggling between rheumatology and hematology to figure out what to do and where the problem was. Because from the rheumatology side, you know, they had bad inflammation and it was difficult to control with any other drug besides glucocorticoids. But we couldn't explain why they were getting progressive cytopenia, why their marrow was failing. So we were going to our hematology oncology colleagues and saying, what's happening in the marrow? And they were saying to us, well, we've looked at the marrow. There's nothing clearly that we recognize. And they have very bad inflammation. So maybe their bone marrow problems are just secondary to that inflammation. And back and forth we went, and the patients went back and forth between our two disciplines until we sort of unlocked the insight that kind of linked everything together.
Can you tell us a bit more about the key clinical manifestations?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenotype. So maybe I'll take a step back and just tell you what the key clinical symptoms are, because it's actually a very easy diagnosis to make and to recognize when you know what you're looking for. So they have a lot of different symptoms throughout their body. A lot of different organs can be involved, but there's a few that are really key. And that is the skin, the eyes, the cartilage, the lungs, and the blood vessels. So these patients will get recurrent skin infections, and it's a wide spectrum of things, but often neutrophilic dermatosis, so sweet syndrome, and they'll get urticarial-like lesions, and they'll get vasculitis of the skin, either small or medium vessels. And they get ear and nose chondritis. That's why they kind of look like relapsing polychondritis. They get inflammatory eye disease, and they get this unusual periorbital inflammatory swelling. And then they can also get ground glass infiltrates in their lungs, which turns out to be a sterile neutrophil alveolitis. It looks like potentially a pneumonia, but isn't. And as well, they get exudative pleural effusions. So if you see this combination of, you know, recurrent skin, eye, lungs, blood vessel, cartilage inflammation, you think about VEXAS. But the real clinical tell is it's a disease of older men. And it's important to understand the genetics of disease to understand why this is a disease almost exclusively in older male populations. And what's going on in this disease and what's why it's so unusual is that it's a somatic mutation. It's an acquired mutation that's happening later in life. So unlike a lot of Dan Kastner's, you know, pediatric onset diseases, these are autoinflammatory diseases where children are born with inborn errors of immunity. They inherit a mutation from their parents, and the disease expresses early in life. In VEXAS, this is a mutation that occurs in your bone marrow and only in your bone marrow and blood, not in any other cell of the body, but it occurs sometime later in life when you're an adult. And it explains a couple things, why the disease presents late, and why the disease wouldn't really run in families. It's not heritable. But the disease is exclusively to men because the gene that's mutant in VEXAS, which is UBA1, is on the X chromosome. So if you're female with two X chromosomes and you acquire this mutation, you're protected by your second one. But for males who have one X chromosome, if they acquire this mutation, they're likely to get this disease. And we've seen that this mutation is almost 100% penetrant in men. So if you acquire it, you will get the disease. So putting all that together, you know, an older man who's got recurrent inflammation in the skin, the cartilage, the eyes, the lungs, that's a patient really you should think about VEXAS. And if they've got progressive bone marrow failure or cytopenia, then that it becomes way more likely that this is the right diagnosis. In terms of progression and severity, it's like any other complex inflammatory disease. We do see some milder cases and we see life-threatening serious cases. On balance, it's one of the more severe life-threatening diseases that rheumatologists would take care of. The mortality rate of this disease is roughly 50% mortality by 10 years after symptom onset. So a lot of patients will die from this condition, but the goal is to get better at managing it, to discover better treatments, and to kind of push that out. And I think that's already happening just with naming the disease and recognizing it. I think standard of care is starting to improve.
Can I just jump in with a question here? Clearly, the disease has quite a diverse phenotype. So I'm wondering, can the UBA1 mutation genotype tell you anything about how the disease will manifest? Would it maybe give you a clue about how it might progress in a particular patient?
Well, we have an early insight into that. It's quite interesting. So the majority of patients that have been diagnosed genetically with VEXAS have mutations that cluster in one hot spot of the UBA1 gene. So this is at codon 41. And what happens is you get an amino acid substitution. There's usually a methionine amino acid at that codon, and you substitute for one of three different amino acids, valine, a leucine, or a threonine. And so often we will refer to these patients as having the valine variant, the leucine variant, the threonine variant. And depending on which variant the patient has, there is prognostic value. So the patients with the valine variant have the most severe disease. They tend to have the most inflammation, fevers, the fastest progressive bone marrow failure, and they die the earliest. And in our initial cohort, no patient with the valine variant has survived longer than 12 years from symptom onset. So these are patients we know up front we need to be more aggressive in how we think about management. The leucine variant is the better prognosis, but better prognosis meaning that there's less mortality in the first 5 years, but then you will start to see mortality even with that disease. And these are patients with predominant skin disease, a lot of sweet syndrome. And the threonine variant is the most common variant in VEXAS. Often these are the older men with relapsing polychondritis type phenotype, and they have an intermediate prognosis. But where it gets more interesting is that, you know, we recognize VEXAS in this clinical way, and most of these patients have one of these three variants. But genetic testing is now widespread available, and people are ordering it in all sorts of indications. Sometimes maybe it wasn't even something we would have recommended or thought about. And then it's returning new variants in different parts of the UBA1 gene. And as that's happening, we're starting to see expansion of the phenotype and different prognosis and different symptoms. And a lot of that has looked like more hematologic features and less inflammation features. And that makes sense to us because there was selection bias in the initial patients we discovered. They were coming to the NIH into these inflammation clinics. And now in hematology, we're kind of seeing a bigger spectrum of this condition with different mutations in different parts of the gene. And I think this will continue to evolve over time. We will see more and more aspects of this disease. I think one of the big areas there is, will this disease have manifestations in females? And that's a question that's really left unanswered at this point.
Thank you. That's really clear and clearly lots to unravel still. With my next question, you've already addressed it to a certain degree, but I'm going to ask it anyway, just so you can really spell it out for our listeners. Given the genetic basis of the condition, when should doctors consider testing?
So we think it's a clinical diagnosis in the sense that you have to have features within the spectrum of VEXAS that must be genetically confirmed. And what's amazing to me as a rheumatologist is we make our diagnoses often by just pattern recognition. And that requires a lot of experience, particularly for these complex diseases. And now we have molecular diagnostics, and it's in the rheumatology clinic. And this disease was discovered about 5 years ago. And now it's very easy in the United States to get genetic testing for VEXAS through a number of different commercial companies, and you can have results back in a week or two. So if you think about it, this is a send out blood test or marrow test, and you can get these results back, which I think is transformative to rheumatology, but there's a big growth curve there of rheumatologists having to learn how to both think about sending genetic tests and then the challenges and pitfalls of potentially of interpreting them. But because it's so easy now to get this test, I think that, you know, if this disease occurs to you in your differential and it's plausible, you should test for them. And I think, you know, it's hard to be a bit dogmatic about these are the patients you have to test, these are patients you shouldn't test, because we keep learning that this disease has expansion of phenotype. But I can say if you have an older male patient with skin, cartilage, you know, lung inflammation, and particularly if they have certain findings on their complete blood count, you should test. So the CBC in this disease is very characteristic. And the things that you look for are a macrocytosis. That's one of the early, most sensitive hematologic signs. So they get an elevated MCV, often over 100. Not every patient will have this in the initial couple years of disease, but it is a pretty good clue. They get progressive anemia, so it's a macrocytic anemia. They'll get progressive thrombocytopenia. And if you look at the white blood cell count, there is a specific pattern. Often the neutrophils are preserved, but their monocytes become low, their lymphocytes become low, their NK cells are low. So if you see any of that kind of pattern, you should test for this disease.
That's an excellent summary that I'm sure our listeners will really appreciate. And so as a more theoretical question, do you see a role for wider screening for this syndrome? I mean, not quite population level, but wider testing than just at the individual level, maybe?
Well, we do have population genetic data on this, and that's where things are getting more interesting when we talk about sex-specific differences in this. A couple of groups have looked at population genetic data, and tried to determine the prevalence of VEXAS. And so for starters, the prevalence is quite high. From the initial estimates that we did in the Geisinger healthcare system, the prevalence was thought to be around 1 in 14,000 people, which means that it's probably the second most common form of vasculitis, if you consider VEXAS a vasculitis, in adults beyond giant cell arteritis. It's more common than diseases like ALS. It's more common than any of the myelodysplastic syndromes combined. And if you enrich down to the target population of people that get this disease, so men older than 50, it's 1 in 4,000. That means there's more than 1 million people in the world with VEXAS. And clearly, we haven't diagnosed that many, so we're missing it. The other thing that the population genetics teaches us is that we see more female cases with pathogenic UBA1 mutations than we would expect clinically. And we don't yet know what these patients look like clinically. Because when you look at the data, they're often female patients that have lower clone burden in blood, so less mutation in their blood than their male counterparts. And when the challenge has been that we haven't been able to directly clinically evaluate them. But if you look at chart review or the sort of low-level data that we have access to, they don't appear to have obvious VEXAS. There have been case reports of VEXAS in women who are karyotypically normal, XX, or in women who have a chromosomal abnormality, XO, Turner syndrome, or monosomy of the X. Those patients look exactly like their male counterparts, but is there a subset of female patients with lower clonal burden that have some subtle or less characteristic features of, that are within the spectrum of VEXAS? We don't know that. But this disease is really everywhere. And the thing that makes it, I think, quite remarkable is for a newly discovered disease at the NIH, you know, most physicians think, I'm never going to see this. There's probably 20 of these cases in the world. That is not true for VEXAS. Every single time any of us on the VEXAS team goes and gives medical grand rounds, there's always a light bulb going off in a physician's head that, oh, I have one of these patients. And that's been really gratifying, I think. But it also is daunting because we have to get the word out. We've done a good job in rheumatology and hematology. We need to do a better job in dermatology, who are often the first physicians that see these patients because it often starts in the skin. But we're seeing better medical awareness, and we're seeing in our cohort at the NIH of referrals in patients being diagnosed faster. We're seeing the disease in its earlier and earlier stages. And because it's a clonal disease that's progressive over time, it's highly likely that intervention early really does matter in this disease. It's not your usual relapsing, remitting rheumatologic disease where you're looking for the right drug. It's probably a disease where you got to catch it early and you're probably going to have more success therapeutically if you start interventions earlier.
That leads really nicely into the next question. Can you tell us a bit about the management of VEXAS syndrome?
So for a couple of years when we were given talks about this, we would talk about the exciting pathophysiology and how conceptual this disease was and, you know, all of these things. And we would give short shrift to the treatment section because we didn't have good therapies. And fortunately, that's starting to change a bit, which is really, really exciting for us because the key reason to discover these diseases, to name them, to define them, is to arrive at better, you know, directed therapies and help patients. From the treatment end, the way to think about the disease is there's three ways to manage it. So one would be controlling the inflammation part of the disease, and two would be getting rid of the mutation, so, you know, eradication of the clone. And then the third way is all the general practice that you need to do specific to the disease, so prophylactic strategies and things like this. Most of the initial treatment efforts focused on the inflammation because that's a very obvious part of the disease. These patients will have C-reactive protein levels in the hundreds and they will be quite inflamed. And we learned originally that the only thing that was working was steroids. And patients would have very specific steroid thresholds. You know, you could have a patient on 20 milligrams of prednisone, they're great. You go to 17.5 milligrams a day and they flare. And so we really did need to find steroid-sparing therapies because long-term use of steroids are associated with all of these problems, particularly in older populations. And if you look at the data in our VEXAS cohort, the average steroid dose, prednisone dose, for a typical patient is between 15 to 30 milligrams of prednisone a day, just a lot of steroids. And we cannot get them lower than that. So we need other therapies. And because this is a disease, the mutation starts in your bone marrow. It clonally expands through your myeloid cells, through your neutrophils and monocytes. So it's a disease of innate immunity. And that's the way to think about it. You would treat, you know, inflammation aspects of the innate immune system. So often those are cytokines like interleukin-1, interleukin-6. And so not surprisingly, the main approaches for steroid-sparing therapy are things like interleukin-6 inhibitors, interleukin-1 inhibitors, JAK inhibitors, which inhibit a lot of different innate cytokines. And we found that those drugs make patients feel better. They keep them out of the hospital, but they do not allow significant reduction in their steroid requirements, and they don't touch the clone. The clone continues to progress. So their bone marrow failure, their trajectory of their cytopenia marches on despite use of these meds. So that was real perplexing for rheumatologists. We're very used to these anti-cytokine therapies working great and getting patients completely off steroids. And remission has become our expectation for so many rheumatologic diseases. Not the case here. And the biggest mistakes in VEXAS management is rheumatologists or other physicians tapering their steroids too quickly, thinking that if they start one of these drugs, they're going to get them off steroids. And it just doesn't work. So there is a role for anti-inflammatory therapies, but it's not durable enough. It's not the medicines we need. The bigger breakthrough has come very recently with the repurposing of hypomethylating agents, drugs like azacitidine, which are used to treat myelodysplastic syndromes. And in some ways, VEXAS is within a spectrum of a myelodysplastic syndrome. And what's got us very excited is that in subsets of patients who receive these agents, we reduce the amount of mutation in their blood and in their bone marrow. And in many patients, after about a year of therapy, those mutations become undetectable in blood and marrow. And when that happens, these are patients that we can get to lower doses of steroids or even get off steroids, and the patients feel a lot better. So I think this is a big breakthrough that's being explored. But conceptually, what it tells us is that we can find medical therapies that are cytotoxic to the clone, that kill the clone. That's what medical therapy of the future will look like in VEXAS. And can we find more and more specific, precise therapies to do that? The other aspect is prophylaxis. So these patients are profoundly susceptible to atypical and opportunistic infections, PJP, pneumonia, non-tuberculosis mycobacterial infections. And when they get these infections, they die. The number needed to treat to prevent death from PJP pneumonia is around 4 or 5 patients. So every patient gets prophylaxis for that. Every patient we consider prophylaxis for alpha herpes viruses, they get a lot of recurrent zoster and all these other complications. And then sometimes we think about antifungal prophylaxis. So that's very important. And then there's a big clotting signal in the disease. 40-50% of these patients will have thromboembolic disease, arterial or venous clots. It clots more than Behçet's, which is in rheumatology our clotting inflammatory disease. So thinking about anticoagulation strategies is really important. But we've also gone from discovery of a disease to cure in less than a couple years, because you can cure these patients. And the way you cure them is with allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. Because this is a mutation that arises in the bone marrow and is only restricted to the blood, if you do a bone marrow transplant in these patients, you can cure them. The challenge there is that there's a lot of complications from transplant. The mortality rates are high in transplant, and there's morbidity from graft versus host disease and infections. And the patient has to be healthy enough to do this. And we're talking about a population of men who are on average in their late 60s, who have been on steroids for a while and have a lot of comorbidities. So selection of appropriate candidates for transplant is challenging, but it is an option. And as we're seeing younger and younger patients, these are the ones we're trying to get to transplant somewhat expeditiously. So that is the 10,000 foot view of where we are in the VEXAS treatment thing. But it's amazing to be able to talk about some of this stuff, because just a couple years ago, we had really just only had steroids.
Are we at the point of having standardized treatment protocols or clinical recommendations?
So there are some of the first randomized controlled trials are starting to happen now. A group of us internationally got together, and we've had 2 VEXAS workshops, the first one in Paris, France, the second one in New York City, the third one coming up this September in Milan, Italy. And from the first workshop, we actually wanted to create some sort of guideline document. And so we drafted position statements and we sent that to the American College of Rheumatology, and they provided endorsement, and those were just published this year. They're not exactly guidelines because the quality of evidence isn't there yet, but they are guidance documents. But I would refer people to that. It's a really useful document to start to learn about the disease and kind of figure out where the things that we know versus we don't know. And there's really a strong international community of people that are interested in this disease. And so things are moving quite quickly, which is amazing to see. And the other aspect about it that's really great is it's multidisciplinary. I mean, this disease by its nature crosses medical disciplines and doesn't respect those boundaries. So we have to have rheumatologists working with immunologists, working with hematologists, working with dermatologists, working with geneticists. And, you know, I think it illustrates this is a disease that was kind of hiding in plain sight. And the reason why we missed it is because it was spread out across all these medical disciplines. So it really does create a new framework for us to start to think about research across disciplines, to be able to speak the same languages, which has taken a little bit of time. And that only serves the patients better so that they're not bouncing back and forth between medical disciplines and those disciplines are unsure, you know, who owns the disease. I think this is a disease that really crosses that. And because of that, we've proposed a term for VEXAS as a prototype form of disease called hematoinflammatory diseases. So you have autoimmune diseases, and then the great Dan Kastner coined the term autoinflammatory diseases. And we think that this is hematoinflammatory disease, a disease caused by genetic mosaicism in blood, so acquired mutations in blood that can produce systemic inflammation that over time can evolve into hematologic malignancies like myelodysplastic syndromes, myeloproliferative syndromes, lymphoproliferative syndromes. And we think there will be more diseases discovered in this vein.
Brilliant. So you've obviously talked about quite a lot of advances that have already happened in a very short time, but still just looking to the future, what are the other kind of promising areas of research, do you think? So, you know, I'm just thinking, for example, gene therapy or CAR T cell therapy, would any of those be things that would be researched?
I think there are possibilities. Gene therapy would be more promising for this disease than CAR T therapy because this is often, for most patients, a point mutation in a single amino acid. So it's a lot like sickle cell disease, where gene therapy has been very promising. The pathway to get there is long. And so it is a potential option. CAR T therapy, much more difficult because we don't have a surface antigen that would be targeted on these cells. And if you actually think about the burden of disease, if you take out a patient's blood and you sequence it, you will find no mutation in their T cells and B cells because if you're a developing T cell or B cell, you don't tolerate this mutation. It's why the patient's lymphocyte counts are very low because a lot of these mutant lymphocytes are dying in the bone marrow. But if you look at their myeloid cells, their neutrophils, their monocytes, up to 80%, 90% of the cells will carry this mutation. So, you know, trying to do sophisticated approaches like CAR T, it's challenging because you really have to almost be myeloablative in this. But I think the promise is, like, as I mentioned, the idea that we have cytotoxic therapies that could get rid of the clone medically is probably the future. And when you think about that conceptually, where we've come in rheumatology as a rheumatologist, you know, we started out originally with these cytotoxic chemotherapies, drugs like cyclophosphamide, which we were giving indiscriminately to patients and causing a lot of toxicity because we didn't have selectivity to those agents. And then we entered this phase of, you know, anti-cytokine therapies, therapies that are more directive, less immunosuppressive, where we can get most patients in remission. And that's been a wonderful time in rheumatology. But we all know those drugs are not curative, right? They're temporizing. So where do we need to go is probably back to cytotoxic therapy, but we just need to do it selectively. So if we can find clonal populations of cells that are driving our diseases and exploit some aspect of their biology to selectively kill them, that's really going to be exciting because that's going to get us to where we've wanted to go forever, which is cure.
And then before I wind up, just one final question. Could you maybe just talk about kind of the broader implications of VEXAS in medicine? So, you know, this idea of somatic mutations in non-malignant disease.
Yeah, this is the hardest thing for, I think, the rheumatology community to have gotten their head around. The hematology community are well-versed in this. You know, this is the concept that if you look at most rheumatologic diseases, they don't run in families and they don't start early in life. So the idea of germline genetics, something you inherit from your parents, give to your children, doesn't make a lot of sense with most epidemiology of rheumatology diseases. But the idea of somatic mutations, that, you know, a somatic mutation is a mutation that occurs sometime after conceptualization. So it could be after conception. So it could be, you know, in utero, it could be early childhood, but it can be all the way throughout adulthood. And I think this opens up this box. It's kind of the cancer paradigm, but applied to inflammatory diseases. You acquire a mutation that gives a growth advantage. That's a malignancy. But if you acquire a mutation, particularly in blood, that gives a slight growth advantage to that blood, and at the same time activates it or makes it toxic or inflammatory, then that could drive rheumatologic disease. So this is basically, you know, non-malignant diseases, but the same concept of acquired mutations causing the disease. And if you think about it, we are acquiring mutations in every organ system of our body continuously as we age. So on that background, it's probably very likely that diseases do occur. And there's an emerging list of diseases caused by somatic mutations, things like paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, single organ diseases, so AVMs have a somatic mutation component. So there's just, this is ripe for discovery. And I think VEXAS is probably one of the first ones to be found because it's an X-linked gene in men. So you only have to deal with one allele and it's a massive clone. You know, like I said, it's 60 to 80 to 90% of myeloid cells have this mutation. So it's just a giant clone floating around. Where we're going to go, though, is the smaller clones, the cryptic ones, the indolent ones. And I think those are going to be in lymphocyte populations, not in myeloid populations. So if you have a clone in a myeloid population, it could produce an autoinflammatory syndrome, a fever disease, you know? But if you have a clone in a lymphocyte population, that could produce an autoimmune disease. And that may be more familiar to rheumatologists, adult rheumatologists that take care of patients with more autoimmune spectrum stuff. But to find these is going to be the challenge because you can't just sequence peripheral blood. For VEXAS, you can. It's easy to see. But if you have a small lymphocyte clone, if you sequence blood, you're not going to be at the depth of coverage to see this. So we're going to have to find different ways to find these. And I sort of alluded to it briefly in some venues, but we think we've found one of these lymphocyte clonal forms of vasculitis. And we're just getting ready to kind of unleash it on the world and try to get it published. But the challenge of it is, how do you find them? Because it's a needle in a haystack. But I think it's going to open up this broader spectrum of what these diseases can look like in rheumatology.
Brilliant. Thank you. We look forward to finding out more about this cryptic disease. I will thank both of you for your time today. Sarah, thank you so much for joining and being enthusiastic about this idea. And Dr. Grayson, just it's been wonderful to be able to pick your brains about it. And, you know, as one of the people who was there from the beginning, your insight is invaluable. So thank you both for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.